Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller, and I'm really happy to have back Patty Nagai. Patty is UW Extension Horticulture Educator. She works out of Racine County. She's been doing this show with me for many years, and we've had so much fun. And today is her last day of work. I don't think it's your last day of really working, but
No, you're
retiring.
I have funny thoughts about that word retirement, because in my head I'm way too young to retire. And I always joke with my children, because I have these wonderful children who are still in school, and I tell them that probably after 2 weeks of retirement they are going to be telling me to go back to work.
Well, it has been so much fun, and we can talk some more about that later. But I mean, I'm so glad and feel kind of privileged to have you on your very last official day.
I can't think of a better way to spend my last day with Extension than answering garden questions for all these wonderful listeners in the state, and with you, Larry, of course. You know, I'm happy to be here.
Well, I'm obviously great to have you here, and let's give our listeners a chance to join in. If you have a question or comment for Patty, I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. Or post on our Facebook page, title, The Larry Mueller Show. And, well, what should we be doing at this? You know, I said, what's there to do and what should we be doing right now?
Well, you could, of course, just be sitting on your couch eating chocolates and petting your dog. Yes, you could do that. But, you know, gardening never ends. Gardening, for gardeners, it is a year-round investment and passion, because there are always things to do. For those who have interior plants, of course, there's always things going on with your interior plants mm-hmm. this time of year, and a lot of those things are not necessarily good. So you might need to be devoting a little bit more care to some of the plants that you have inside. Some people are going to more extremes on their interior plants, and they're doing edible food growing inside using mm-hmm. some extra lighting and some additional heat mats or things, where they might be growing lettuces or even radishes in pots. Mm-hmm. Herbs, of course, are always good. And then, you know, you and I both have the citrus going on in our homes, and that's always fun this time of year. Because
I want to break in right this minute. Patty showed me a photo of her
lemon tree, though, not my lime. That was my lemon tree.
Your lemon tree is loaded.
Yeah, it's
with lemons.
Beautifully formed lemons. Gorgeous, big, juicy lemons just waiting for me to pick them and use them in some way. It's a really nice lemon tree, too. The lemons are very good. They are large and super juicy. I can get close to like a half a cup of juice out of each lemon. It's really a nice lemon tree.
And is it a Bears lemon?
No, this is a Eureka lemon. The Bears is the lime tree.
Yeah, the Bears, limey is right. A Bears.
A Bears lime and a Eureka lemon. A lot of people have Meyer's lemon in their home, and that's a nice one too. The flavor of the lemon juice is a little bit different for a Meyer's, and those lemons are a little bit smaller, but they taste good. But Meyer's is a little bit of a sweeter taste to it. The Eureka is a pretty lemony lemon.
Well, I am very envious, and you know, limey is still producing.
That's good. You're taking good care of
limey. Has not very many leaves left this time of the year.
Well, that's one of those challenges with transitioning from outdoors to indoors with those kind of plants. This is a hard time of year for interior plants in Wisconsin. We have very little sun. Have you noticed?
I have grow lights on practically every single leaf.
That helps. And you know, it's interesting. You can read in a lot of places where they tell you to kind of let your interior plants go dormant and not to fertilize them or anything, just encourage that dormancy. But when you have plants that are actively trying to grow and they're flowering and fruiting, or they already have fruit on the trees, you cannot let them go dormant. And
no.
So those citrus trees and those plants that are flowering, even over the winter months, you still need to be providing nutrition for them in their soil, or they will continue to drop those leaves. Although sometimes they're dropping leaves just because those leaves were developed outside in full sun. And
yeah.
Even with your grow lights, you aren't even approaching what a summer sun is like outdoors. And so they're going to drop those leaves and make new leaves, which are better able to handle those lower light situations. And so you need to be providing nutrition for your soil.
Oh, believe
soil.
Me, I've got the fish
emulsion.
Fish emulsion.
Does it smell funny?
I always put it, I water and use that fish emulsion as I'm leaving the house.
Oh, that's a good way
for
to do
work.
It.
For work. I do it
do
in the morning.
You don't have cats, do you?
I have two cats.
They don't bother it?
They don't, because I put aluminum foil crunched up in the...
That's a good way to do it, yeah. But fish emulsion, you know, that's a great organic-based fertilizer for citrus and for a lot of the houseplants. But a lot of people can't tolerate the smell.
Well,
it's a little... There are some that smell worse than others, too, so you can kind of shop around.
I do it in the morning on my way out of the house, and by the time I get back...
It's okay.
It's okay.
Yeah. No, that's good. But, you know, there are other things that gardeners do this time of year also, and, you know, for the last month, the seed catalogs have been pouring in.
Oh, yeah.
And that is a fabulous winter activity to read through and look at the beautiful pictures in the seed catalogs. There are some things, you know, a lot of people put their seed orders in really early, you know, like October, November, depending on what it is they're ordering. But it's certainly not too late, and there are a lot of wonderful selections of seeds. But it's just something you need to think about and spend a little time on, which is perfect for a snowy day when you are inside and can't be out in your gardens because they're under 2 feet of snow.
Well, I'm telling you right now that Teresa in Appleton, you want to talk about a gardener. I'm pretty sure Teresa's a pretty good one. Teresa, hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for all the comments. I'm calling because my root crops, my carrots and my beets, are still in my garden.
Excellent.
I cover them with straw, and yesterday I harvested fresh carrots and fresh beets.
Oh, that's fabulous.
Isn't that wonderful?
Well, I love this idea, and I encourage it in many different ways to try and maintain those vegetable gardens, you know, in an almost year-round way. So the cool thing about harvesting vegetables when it's super cold, if the ground is not frozen and if you can actually get them out without
a
pickaxe or a jackhammer to break up the soil, is that, you know, when the weather turns cold, those root crops turn very sweet.
Oh,
and their
yeah.
flavor is going to be maximized because they have taken all of their nutrients and forced them down into those roots for overwintering. And then plants have this natural ability to convert starch to sugar in order to protect their cells from freezing. And so you actually will have sweeter plants. Not to brag for my little bit too, but I harvested kale on New Year's Day.
Oh,
and had
it
with my black-eyed peas and rice and ham for good luck and good fortune for the new year. But I was just amazed. I saw the kale out there and I thought, well, it's still standing.
Why not?
It's fine. It might be a little crunchy, but it was so delicious. It was the best tasting kale I've ever put in my mouth.
You're making me so hungry.
And so harvesting, you know, the root crops is fabulous. And, you know, if you can get them out now or before the ground truly freezes, it's best. If you'll find if you wait until spring when the ground thaws again, those plants are already going to be going through that conversion process to send up shoots for the new year. If they're biennials, and if they're not, they're going to start to rot a little bit. But either way, the flavors change considerably once they start trying to push out green growth in the spring.
Yeah.
The root flavors change a lot, and they're often very woody and bitter tasting.
Mm.
So now is the time to harvest, really.
You, right. I'm envious of you, Teresa.
I know.
Thank
I
you.
Wish I did. I didn't have any beets or turnips or
all right.
carrots in my garden. So, but next year when I'm retired and I have more time to garden.
There you go. Well, Michelle Good, who's on our staff here, and you'll hear her voice pretty often on Wisconsin Public Radio, went through the Master Gardener program a while back, and posted a photo of her beets that, and then from a week or so ago, that mm-hmm. she had. She said these are the last from the garden, and they look just
beautiful.
Wonderful.
Yeah. So beets are really cold tolerant. Beets,
yeah.
Turnips, radishes. You know those plants that are in that Brassicaceae family,
yeah.
with, you know, broccoli, cabbage, kale, collards,
yeah.
all of those things. Super cold tolerant. And so a lot of times people will plant those ornamental kales and cabbages in their flower beds, and they look really pretty and they last really long. And they ask me, you know, well, are those edible? They're really pretty, but can you eat them? Absolutely.
Absolutely.
And, you know, wait until it's really super cold and go out there and harvest them, and you're going to have some really sweet-tasting cabbage leaves. And they'll just happen to be pink and purple, which is fine.
Cheryl in Conover, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
On this dreary, icky day.
Yeah. Oh,
a little foggy.
I don't know what it's doing down in Madison, but up north it's pretty icky.
It's pretty icky here.
It's foggy, yeah. and rainy.
Yeah, same here. Mm-hmm. Anyway, the question I have is pretty specific. I want to grow three specific herbs year-round, or actually at least in the winter, in mm-hmm. my house. And
okay.
it would be rosemary, cilantro, and basil.
Okay, and you can do that.
Okay.
I'm just going to...
Do I need light?
Yes.
Okay.
Light is
yes,
essential for herbs. So those are three very different growth habits that are in those three different plants that you mentioned. So rosemary, let's start with rosemary because that's a woody perennial. And if you've ever been out to California, you've probably seen hedges of rosemary. It's a woody shrub.
Yeah, I owned a house with hedges of rosemary.
Right.
And before we moved, I cut enough off to last in dried rosemary for two years.
But you know, it's a really nice interior plant. So
yeah.
I have found that the key to growing rosemary successfully indoors is to never take it outdoors. If you really want to have rosemary inside, it doesn't always handle the transition very well from outdoors to indoors and back and forth, you know, like that. Keep it in a pot. It likes a richer potting soil than a lot of other herbs, but it also likes to be well drained. And so incorporating vermiculite, or in some cases even, you know, and I don't usually recommend this for plants outside, but in interior plants, sometimes having sand in the mix is actually helpful in a small container. It
okay.
gives weight to the pot and it helps with the drainage, but it has to be a lot of sand, you know, almost like 50% sand in order for it to have that effect. So
okay.
rosemary is very sensitive to being completely dry and completely wet. And so by incorporating an aeration type material in the soil mix, sometimes that makes it a little bit easier to keep it from getting overwatered, which is just fatal. Always
okay.
with rosemary, fatal. The other thing is that if you've got a medium to even a large size rosemary plant, bring it over to your sink once a week, wash it off with tepid water, and water it in the sink. Water it thoroughly, let it drain through, and it'll be happy as a clam. But it does like full sun, so find a bright window for it. If it's not enough light for it, you'll start to see leaf drop on the lower leaves and maybe even some yellowing, which can also be an indication of overwatering. You might want to add some lights to it, but I have rosemary growing in a window in my house and it's doing really well. So it is certainly possible to do that. The other two are grown from seed and they have very different...
Now what are the other two again?
Cilantro and basil. So cilantro is super easy to grow. It germinates very quickly. The thing about growing cilantro year-round is if you really want a flush of cilantro growth on a regular basis, you need to set up a grow system where you're sowing seeds every 2 weeks. And so
okay.
you sow seeds in a pot, you wait 2 weeks, you sow seeds in another pot, you wait 2 weeks, you grow. It doesn't really care that much about the soil type. Any kind of potting mix is probably fine for cilantro. If you've ever grown it outside, you know it self-seeds really readily and it just mm-hmm. comes up all over the place. It's very sensitive to light duration, though, so when the days get super long, it starts to, you know, go to flower. You can mimic, you can probably maintain it in a shorter day and keep that leaf foliage from flowering. You can keep it from going from flowering, maybe by manipulating the light length. But there are also some cultivars that are not as sensitive to day length that might be better for interior use. So you might want to look at the cultivars really carefully. Basil is one of the easiest to grow inside. It's also easily grown from seed. We grow in our Greenworks greenhouse, we grow probably 15 different types of basil from seed. They germinate very well. They grow in pretty well even in interior light, normal bright window kind of light. So you might not need any extra lights for basil either. But again, it's one of those things that I would try a lot of different cultivars and see which one works best for you in your interior situation.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it.
That's a great
call.
Question.
Yeah, great question.
I could write that up and make it into a little article. And
you could.
Take some pictures. And
you should do that. You should do
in
that,
in my spare time.
Patty Nagai, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Brianne Schasso, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, as we listen to Garden Talk. Next week on Garden Talk, we'll be visiting with the author of the book, The Right Size Flower Garden, Carrie Mendez, our guest. So looking forward to that, but really happy to have Patty Nagai with us, UW Extension horticulture educator in Racine County. It's her last day of work. She's retiring as of today. And so we're really pleased to have her along. You may have a question for her about your garden or maybe seeds or whatever. Give us a call, 800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And if you got a nice garden photo, we'd love to see that as well on our Facebook page. So go ahead. Mike in Algoma emailed, and he has a 45-year-old grapefruit tree. He started it from a seed, and it has never flowered. Will it ever? It's been 45 years.
If that is true, that it really is 45 years old and it's never flowered, then it's probably not going to. You know, it's really funny when you start plants from seeds. And I do this all the time with my kids, and I've done it all my life. Even when I was a kid, I used to start things from seed all the time just to see what would grow. But the weird thing about citrus is that when you plant a seed of a citrus, it, of course, is going to be a mixed genetics kind of a thing. And so you don't really know exactly what you're getting. But seedlings of citrus are notorious for being very vigorous, very large, and very thorny. Very thorny. Mm-hmm. And rarely do they produce fruit. You know, it's just not done. And it's because most of the citrus that we have are mutations and sports, and they've been developed through strange methods over the years. And so they're all vegetatively propagated. So for example, you know, if you took a cutting off of my lemon tree and planted it, you would get a Eureka lemon. But if you took the seeds out of my Eureka lemons and planted them, you would not get Eureka lemons. And that's true for a lot of fruit crops. You know, we talk about that with apples all the time as well. Apples are vegetatively propagated because the cultivar is the seeds are always going to be the result of cross-pollination from another plant, because apples can't pollinate themselves. And so all the fruit may be a Macintosh fruit. The fruit is female tissue. The seed is the result of male and female tissue. And who knows where the male
came from.
That bee visited. You know, it could be any cultivar of apple or crab apple that just happened to be blooming at the time that the apple tree was ready to receive pollen. So, yeah, it's fun to grow things from seed, but you might not get what you expect.
If you get along the lines of citrus, as long as we're at it, someone else called in and wondered about whether or not you could keep your lemon tree. If you got a lemon tree, let's say, could you keep it inside 12 months of the year?
Sure, you could. And I think the first couple of years I had my lemons, I kept them inside. But they appreciate being outside so much that I always move them out in the May usually is when I move them out, and I move them back in October. So they stay outside on my deck most of the
Yeah, here. I have a nice upstairs deck that's off the bedroom, mm-hmm. and
they really like it. It's nice, you know, and mine are big, and so it's really nice to have them outside because I can then hose them off.
Yeah,
and keep them nice and clean. They get natural rainfall. They do get visited by bees, which helps a lot with the fruit production.
Yeah.
So by the time I bring them back in October, they usually have quite a few fruit on them. Otherwise, when they're inside, it's a little trickier to. We've talked about how to pollinate. Make your little buzzing noises and go from flower to flower.
Yeah. And you can do it with a
Q-tip or a paintbrush or a little, you know, one of those little paintbrushes or even a piece of tissue. You can use your fingers.
A little air.
Yeah. It's you know, citrus are really interesting because they have such strange little flowers. They produce a lot of male flowers, male-only flowers that are, you know, that's the source for the pollen. And then they produce flowers that are perfect. So they have the male and the female parts. And so if you've got a lot of movement, if you're, you know, messing around with your plants a lot, you can get pollination. They are self-fertile, so you can get pollination from those perfect flowers. But if you were just to pick off the male flowers and just go visit the female stigmas with your little male flowers, that helps it along as well. So they're kind of weird because they have different types of flowers on the same tree.
Well, Adriana in Menominee Falls has a question. Adriana,
hi.
Are you there? Hi.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call and congratulations on your last day of work.
Well, thank you.
I have kind of an odd question. I just bought a home in Menominee Falls. Mm-hmm. I have a beautiful raised bed garden, and I actually spend my summers in Alaska.
Oh.
And I would hate for that raised bed to go to waste, so I'm wondering, can I magically plant something in April, and then when I return in September, can I harvest something, and what are the chances of that actually being possible?
You know, miracles do happen, and plants will grow many times without our intervention. We're very, very blessed to have mostly regular rainfall. It's the watering that I would be most concerned about, whether or not they would get regular water if we had a period of drought. So you could lose things if it were droughty. You know, vegetables require a little bit of care, but there are some things that do really well with very minimal care. So if you're really into greens, you could plant collards and kale, and I guarantee you they will be alive and growing and flourishing when you come back, no matter what the weather. They're just very tough. The other alternative is to pick things that are, you know, maybe a little bit that don't require as much care. You know, like I wouldn't try to do... Well, you could try tomatoes and peppers, but...
I do potatoes.
Potatoes would be a good one.
Okay.
Tomatoes and peppers, if you can put them in cages and maybe use a nice thick layer of mulch. But I would introduce yourself to your neighbors and find out if any of your neighbors have children who are interested in gardening, who would be willing to maybe take over watering when needed or, you know, just to kind of watch out for things. I'm a big believer in enlisting kids to help with gardening activities. It's good for them. It's good for you. It's good for the world.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Have a hose out there.
Yeah. So,
potatoes,
good luck with
sure,
that. Potatoes are very resilient, and you plant those pretty early, and they pretty much manage themselves and do quite well if there's not too much moisture, and they would do really well in a raised bed. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yes, there are possibilities, but maybe try a combination of things.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And have fun in Alaska. Summer
in
Alaska.
There are very few states I have not visited, but that is one that I have never been to.
Me too. I haven't been either, and I have some former students. Mm-hmm. who live in Alaska who keep saying, come and visit. And I haven't done it yet.
My cousin lived up there for several years, and I never could get up there to visit him. And now he's in Houston, so. Not quite the same as Alaska.
No. Let's go to Marcia in Fond du Lac next. Hi, Marcia. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I have a question about asparagus.
Okay.
I have an old asparagus bed, and we've tried to keep it going. And my question is, Number one, do you rototill in at all? And number two, if you do rototill, do you do it in the fall, late fall, or spring? And then I believe, if I understand correctly, we should be putting manure, say we have horses, so we could put horse manure down for the winter for it to soak down in. Am I approaching things correctly here? Any good advice to keep this old bed going, because we love asparagus?
Right. Asparagus is an interesting crop because, of course, it is a perennial and it can live many, many, many years, and be very productive for many years if given the right care. Some of the recommendations for asparagus culture have changed over the years. And with a really old bed, the biggest problems that you have are fertility in the soil, but also weed control. When you bring any kind of tiller or any kind of equipment in there to turn the soil, you're going to be damaging the crowns more than likely. And so that's really not a recommended practice. I don't know in commercial fields. I think, you know, they do a lot of tilling in between the rows, but not necessarily where the asparagus is coming up. So some of the organic methods are to use composted manure.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it needs to be composted. Any kind of fresh manure is not advisable for vegetable crops at all. It needs to be fully composted for at least 1 year. And okay. That's because of the potential health food safety issues associated with manures of all kinds. Even though they're your horses, you know, it's still not a safe practice. So manure is a fine source for fertilization, but it does need to be fully composted.
Okay.
Also, if it's fully composted, you shouldn't have the additional problems with weed seeds in there and having to adding weeds to your garden. Weeds are really difficult to get rid of in an asparagus bed once it's established, because I don't think there are any approved herbicides for that. I know people talk about spraying glyphosate and doing things like that. There are some organic herbicides that contain pelargonic acid and acetic acid that can burn off the tops of annual weeds, but they don't really do a whole lot for perennial weeds. So if you've got thistle or anything like that, dandelions in there.
What about salt?
That's an old recommendation too, and that is so risky. I know people do it. I've heard it. I've heard people say they've done it for years with great success, but salt is a horrible thing to add to your soil. It can really mess up your soil structure. And
you could the name of the organic herbicide again. I could maybe think about that, because I have no rows.
Yeah, what I was thinking, since you said it's such an old bed. Typically what happens is the asparagus spreads considerably, and if you've got some of the older cultivars, you probably have female asparagus in there that have been dropping seed. And sometimes asparagus seed is one of the worst weeds that we can have in an asparagus bed.
Oh, interesting.
So the newer cultivars that are recommended are mostly all male cultivars, so that you don't get into that. But they look for an organic herbicide that contains either pelargonic acid or acetic acid. And there are a number of different brands of that organic herbicide on the market that can be used in that situation. But you must follow the label instructions, because those compounds are still very dangerous because they are acids.
Oh, absolutely.
And so they have to be applied to green growing tissue, and they basically only kill the tops of the plants.
And anymore, I'm telling you, these new asparagus varieties, these all-male varieties, there's... It's awfully tempting to say, do away with the old one and put in a new.
Start over. But a lot of people like their old asparagus varieties, and I'm all for trying to maintain those beds.
Sure.
Mulching can help a lot. Adding a thick layer of compost in the fall and even in the spring to help keep those weed seeds from germinating is a great practice. Because the asparagus spears will still come up through that compost. But it does need to be compost. Not fresh manure, or not yard waste or anything like that. It needs to be fully composted.
One of the side benefits is that our birds are planting wild asparagus for us in patches all around.
So. You probably have asparagus everywhere.
Just about. It continues to grow. But the compost idea is excellent, and I think that will help me. And thank you so very much.
Yeah, thanks, Marcia. Thanks a lot for calling. Well, Zach in Milwaukee has a question. Hi, Zach.
Hey, guys. I've got a question about celery. I tried growing a couple plants. They were store-bought, so I'm not really sure if they're a specific type. And I actually don't really like celery all that much, so I was growing it for
just for fun.
Family. But they were a couple people said it was just a little too fibrous.
Right.
And a little too bitter.
Yeah.
I did notice that it was a good deal smaller and more green in color. So I guess I never really knew when it was right to harvest. So I'm not sure if any tips you guys could tell me about things I should avoid.
Yeah. You know, celery.
Fertilizer or when to harvest.
Yeah. So celery is not that hard to grow, actually. It takes a little bit of time to develop, and it can be grown from seed. And that's what I would recommend, is that you purchase seed. And choose one of the cultivars of celery that's a little bit shorter season. So celery, like a lot of plants, will taste better when it's harvested, you know, when it's cool and not so hot. It tends to get a little bit bitter and tough when it gets really warm weather. The reason that it's dark green is that in the commercial production of celery, it gets bound up in sort of a semi-blanching type technique so that it presses all of the petioles together and keeps it the sun from getting to those interior petioles, and it keeps them pale and white. So when you grow celery in your own yard, if you don't bind it in some way to keep the sun off of it, it spreads out and it turns really dark green, and the actual petioles, the stalks of celery, will be smaller and a little bit tougher, because when they're actively photosynthesizing like that, the physiology and the morphology of the petioles changes with mm-hmm. you know, in with response to the sunlight. So that's the deal with the dark green and the toughness. So okay, choose a cultivar that's a little bit shorter season. Grow it from seed. You can play around with some of the blanching techniques for celery to keep it nice and tender. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, it's one of those things, you can harvest it whenever it looks like it's ready to be picked.
There you go.
So maybe put a little rubber band around it to hold it.
Yeah, you know, I don't know that they use, it may be rubber bands that they use, but yeah, that's essentially the thing, is you've got to come up with a way to keep those petioles tightly compressed.
Yeah, it was me. I'd grow something else. I tried celery once.
I've grown it a couple of times.
Do it again.
I've grown it a couple of times. I've never done the blanching.
Mm-hmm.
And they probably make little gadgets to do that. And I would think that, you know, if you bought them by the thousands, it probably wouldn't be very expensive.
You know what else they do? They sell really good celery
in the grocery store. Yeah, it's true. Celery is one of those strange little vegetable crops, though. It's you know, it's like growing endive. There are some specialized techniques to getting it to grow correctly, to where it's really what you're expecting, as in grocery store quality vegetables. But the flavor of celery, homegrown celery, when harvested young and not, you know, don't let it get to the point where it's super tough. But if you harvest it when it's young, the flavor is excellent. It really has a strong celery taste.
Patty Nagai, our guest today, and I haven't given the number in forever. So, and here we are with lots of open lines. So you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. And, of course, we have many emails and so forth. Diane and Pepin wonders, when's a good time to prune apple trees? She has a 40-foot tree and wonders if she can just cut the top off. Well, no. and she says she has a young ginkgo tree that's about, this is a different question, but the same person. 5-year-old ginkgo, and she wants to remove the lower main branches and wonders if that's okay.
Well, she wants to do some tree abuse, and sometimes it's okay to do a little bit of tree abuse, but let's talk about the time to prune first. So this is not the time of year to be pruning apple trees. We have some really severe cold weather ahead of us, and apple trees do not like to be pruned when it's super cold.
Mm-hmm.
So we typically recommend that pruning be held off until late February, mid to late February or March, depending on the weather. I wait for a really nice, warm, sunny day so that I'm not battling the elements to do it. But the key is to get out there before the buds swell. And get that pruning done. But spring is a great time to prune apple trees and ginkgo trees, for that matter, if she needs to remove those branches. Ginkgo is one of those trees that I would prefer people didn't mess with too much. But if those branches are in the way, spring is the time to take those off. With respect to topping a 40-foot apple tree, if your tree is 40 feet tall, it's an indication that it was not pruned correctly when it was younger.
Yeah.
Topping it is risky for that age of a tree, but if you think about where apples are produced and how difficult it is to maintain a tree that's 40 feet tall, the worst thing that could happen is the tree dies, then in which case you purchase a new one and prune it correctly from the start. And Extension has some great information on pruning apple trees.
Yeah.
Apple trees are, a lot of times people plant them and they don't understand why they're not flowering and fruiting. But if they're not maintained correctly from the first year on, you're not going to get good flower and fruit production throughout the life of the tree. So that's a tree that requires a significant amount of care and a lot of regular annual pruning to keep it shaped up. So if I had a 40-foot apple tree, like if I inherited one, I probably would go in and top it and remove at least a third of its branches and try to shape it up so that the branch angles were correct and get rid of all of the water sprouts and suckers and crossing branches, diseased, dead, dying branches, clean it up really well and give it a year or two and see if it actually produces well. But if it didn't, I would take it out and plant a new one.
Do a little pruning right at the base.
Yeah, sometimes pruning at the base is the best thing to do. It's terrible for a horticulturist to say that, but...
No, yeah, it's not.
Well, it's the way it is.
Tom in Barnum, Minnesota, wanted to congratulate you on your retirement.
Well, thank you, Tom.
And he also wonders what you would suggest for new vegetable gardeners in terms of focusing as they develop their gardening skills.
I would focus on what you like to eat.
Mm-hmm.
Keep it simple, keep it small. Make sure that you are using a lot of compost and really thinking about what you're planting. Don't be afraid to try new things. It's a vegetable garden. If they die, you plant something else. So the cool thing about vegetable gardening, unlike bulbs or perennial beds or shrub beds or trees where you have a lot of time and invested in those plants in that garden area, a vegetable garden is constantly changing and constantly being renewed. And so with the exception of those perennial vegetables that you might have like asparagus or rhubarb, it can change month to month. And that is the beautiful thing about vegetable gardening. It's very forgiving or easy to forget that you had a crop failure with your carrots, but now you have beautiful peppers in their place, and that's just a fabulous thing. So I would say, for a newbie in vegetable growing, keep it simple to start with, but don't be afraid to try new things and just get out there and garden. I always tell people that, yes, I know a lot about vegetables. I've been gardening all my life.
Mm-hmm.
I learned a huge amount from my grandfather as a child, working in his vegetable garden. But the way you learn is by doing it. You can read books, you can listen to me, you can watch shows on television, but you really need to get out there in the garden before you actually start to learn about how plants grow.
However, I would also advise people, if you're just getting started, And he's with in Minnesota, but Minnesota Extension and mm-hmm. UW Extension in Wisconsin produce some of the best publications.
We do have some great publications. Yes.
On a whole host of vegetables and mm-hmm. flowers and whatever. And it's certainly not a bad idea.
No, I'm all for reading and researching and talking to other gardeners.
But you still have to
get out there and do it.
You're absolutely right. Patty Nagai, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us for this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller with my guest, Patty Nagai, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Racine County. She is on her last day of work, official day anyway. My goodness me.
It's very exciting. It really is exciting. There's a lot to be said for change and for, mm-hmm. Making these big decisions. My family, I think, will appreciate me having more time for them, at least initially, until they
get sick of it.
The kids get sick of me and say, go back to work, Mom. But change can be a very positive thing.
Oh, yeah.
And so I have a lot of things on my to-do list.
A lot of things you want to do.
A lot of things that I would like to do. And, as a gardener, there are always things to do. And there's nothing I enjoy more than actually being in my own gardens, working mm-hmm. with my children or my neighbors. Mm-hmm. I do a lot of gardening with neighbors and friends. And I'll still have that opportunity to answer people's questions and do some writing. So I'm very much looking forward to it.
Well, do you ever deal with slugs in your garden? Sally in Madison.
My gosh. Slugs.
Her garden is full of slugs.
Yes. They can be a problem once they get set up house in a garden. And so they go after cool, damp, dark places.
Yeah.
And once they get established, they eat and they breed and they're just happy as little slugs in your garden. And they're just going to continue to do that until you take care of them. They're often associated with earwigs because earwigs like that same type of situation. There are some really nice organic products out there on the market to help control slugs. You can look at the environment, though, and see if there's something you can change about the environment. So if you have a lot of leaf litter or if you have a heavy layer of mulch, you might want to consider removing that leaf litter or that mulch at least for a season to try and make it a little bit less hospitable for them. They typically arise in vegetable gardens that are heavily mulched and also under hostas and shade plants because it's nice and cool and dark. There are lots of traps you can use to trap them. There's the half beer bottle buried in the soil and bowls of beer and rolled up newspapers and things like that. But there are some good organic products out there that'll take care of slugs that are safe to use in all types of gardens. And they contain the compound iron phosphate.
Oh, that's what
they
don't like.
So iron phosphate is a great thing to take care of slugs. And if you can break their happy cycle, you can go a long way to controlling them in the future. But you got to break that happy cycle, so you need to make it less hospitable for them. A lot of people will put down things like diatomaceous earth or broken up eggshells because they think about their tender little bodies being cut. Diatomaceous earth is a really tiny, very sharp, granular product that's also used for organic gardening, and that will help. But the iron phosphate works really well, too. So there are lots of options, but it's going to take a little effort on your part to do that.
Bob in Plover up next with a question. Hi, Bob. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Bob.
Bob, are you there?
Oh, we've lost him. Oh, there he is.
I made a comment before regarding asparagus growing and also interior plants, and I don't know if that went through or not, but if you got time, I'd like to share a couple things with you.
Okay, go ahead.
Asparagus planting, my background is horticulturist from UW-Madison years ago, a graduate, and I have two 50-foot asparagus beds. What I do is I just add in the springtime, as the lady had said there, compost, bag compost,
right.
Put over the
mm-hmm.
top, and that's really all I do. irrigation is important for sandy soils. Otherwise, other than that, I do, some years I'll leave the stalk standing over the winter. Sometimes I won't. This winter I took it down. Mm-hmm. But we're also concerned with pathogens and with insects. So if that's a problem, you probably want to remove your stalks in the fall and the winter prior to that. And,
I think she was doing that. I think she was removing the stalks. I think it's just that she was concerned about the fertility of the soil and the weed control. But I agree with you. I think the compost is probably the most practical and safest way to handle both of those things, both the fertility as well as the weed control. So those are good practices, and cutting them back in the fall is a good practice to get into too. Great.
And I also don't cultivate. I, like you said, I shallow rooted crop, stay away from that. I know also of commercial gardeners do that too. They don't cultivate it either. So as far as weed control, it's a hard one. Quackgrass, mm-hmm. Maybe glyphosate, but you got to be careful. If the spears are coming up, you can try, if quackgrass germinates or comes up quicker than the spears, maybe you can do a quick cursor over the top.
Right. But it's tough.
It is tough. And the weed control in asparagus beds has always been a big issue. So if they're not maintained properly, I think it's great that she's kept the asparagus beds as long as she has. Yeah. And that means that she's been doing some things right. And even in the thing about asparagus is it's so tough that even in a poorly maintained asparagus bed, if it's getting sunlight and, water in a reasonable situation, you're still going to get some spears. You might not get optimal production of spears, but you're still going to get some spears because we see them in the wild. We have people who go out and harvest those wild asparagus all the time.
Bob, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call and your input. Yeah. I want to give Charlene and Fenimore a chance to join us. Hi, Charlene.
Hi. I have a comment regarding the person who's trying to grow celery.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If you put, when it first comes up, if you put a half-gallon milk cartons around it, that gives it the shape and it also keeps it dark.
Oh, that's a great idea. Yeah, so it gives it a little bit of light, but it really cuts down on the light.
Yeah, if you cut the tops off and the bottoms off and just slip it over.
Oh, it's the perfect size, yeah. Half-gallon.
A little bit, right. So it doesn't, fall over. Yeah, it grows really well. And if you chop it up, it freezes really well and works great for soups.
Right. Do you remember what cultivar you planted?
No, I do not.
Okay.
And I did grow it from seed. I wanted to do it just for the fun of it, and I grew it from seed.
That's a great idea. You know what? I'm going to use that in my garden this year. I'm going to try a celery again. Last year we grew Utah celery, and it did okay, but it was it was kind of slow. So I was going to look for a different cultivar this year to try. But I will definitely try your half-gallon milk carton idea.
That's a great
idea.
To
maintain the shape and cut down on the light interception. That's really great. That's great. Thank you.
Thanks, Charlene. Appreciate it. Learn something new every day on this program.
Well, it's true, and that's one of the fabulous things about gardeners is that, you always can learn more from other people.
And they're always willing to share.
I know. I like it when they share their produce, too, though.
That, got that right. Dan in Duluth, Minnesota has a question. Hi, Dan.
Hey, Larry. Yes, and Patty. I have a question and a comment.
Okay.
Quick question is, Patty, you were mentioning March being a good time to prune apple trees. I was wondering if that would be all right as well for a mountain ash tree. And then the comment was, if you're retiring, WPR should find an hour of airtime for you for once a week.
My own show.
Own show.
That's a great idea. I'll have to talk to Larry about that after the show.
That'd be wonderful. We could do some sort of national garden show.
That would be so much fun. Just think of the things I could learn if we broadened our horizons to, like the South and California. It would be fabulous. Pruning, there... Late winter, early spring is a great time to prune almost everything. There are some things that we are more careful about. So, for example, if you're trying to prune oak trees, you do not want to prune an oak. You want to make sure that that gets pruned before the middle of April in southeast Wisconsin. So, if you're in a different part of Wisconsin, it might be a little bit later than that. But in general, that March time frame is a great time to prune. Ideally, you would want to select a day that was warm and dry. You don't want to prune in wet weather, and that can be a challenge in spring because we often have very wet weather. But wetness is a great way to spread disease, so you need to be cognizant of that and make sure that you're cleaning your pruning tools, no matter when you're pruning, but especially if it's a little bit damp. But yeah, spring's a great time. If you're trying to prune something that blooms in the spring, you have to remember that everything you prune in March is a potential blossom. And that's true for apples too, but for apple production and crab apples, spring still is the best time to prune.
Yeah.
So sure, mountain ash can be pruned in the spring. They are very susceptible to a bunch of different things, though. So I'd be really careful to make sure that you're cleaning your pruning tools very carefully.
And to go along with that, somebody wondered about lilacs and dogwoods, and in 1 minute.
Yeah, sure. So lilacs and dogwoods can be pruned in the spring as well. But remember, lilac is a spring bloomer, and you're going to be removing blossoms. So don't just cut the thing back. Do some selective pruning and some cleaning up. With lilacs, you should be pruning those pretty regularly and removing the old wood.
The biggest ones.
Leaving the new wood, because those will be the best blossomers for you. We often recommend that those get pruned after blossom. But physiologically, for the health of the plant, it's always better to prune before they leaf out.
And you're looking at about a third of the plant you can take out?
Sure. Up to a third of the branches is a pretty safe recommendation for most woody plants. Dogwoods need to be cleaned up too, whether they're red twig and you're looking for that new red growth, or you're pruning a pagoda, that alternifolia with the nice lateral branches. You want to make sure you're getting rid of the upward growing things and clean it up.
Patty Nagai, our guest today on this last day of her employment with UW Extension. Always great to have her with us for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us for this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller with Patty Nagai, UW Extension horticulture educator in Racine County, on this her last day of work for UW Extension. It was wonderful to have her with us on this special day. And great to have you listening in. And we have so many callers online. The number, by the way, is 800-642-1234. Norman in Wausau has a question, so let's go there. Norman, hi. Thank you for calling.
How are you doing?
Great. Appreciate your call. What's on your mind?
Well, I talked to Patty in the past about these citrus plants. You guys keep seeming to grow like magic, and I've gone through about 9 plants, and the longest I've made it is 3 years.
You have not followed my advice, Norman, have you? You just listen to me, and you keep calling for with questions, but you're not really doing what I'm telling you, are you?
I tried it, believe it or not. I got the vermicompost.
Yeah.
I did the stuff with the fish
emulsion.
Then I even tried to put heat on the bottom of the pots in the inside. In other words, I got a heat mat under them.
Oh, my gosh.
And then I used 100-watt LED bulbs. But I used a photometer, and I found out that the light coming through in our sunroom was much brighter than the light even at 6 inches from those 100 watts.
Right.
So I did find that out. But my question was, are you guys buying plants that have a different root system? Because I'm wondering if those Meyer lemons have some sort of a dwarfing root system, and that may be why I'm having trouble growing them, whereas you guys are having other varieties of citrus and seem to have no problem.
Well, my lemons are Eureka lemons, but I know other people who grow Meyer with no problem, and different types of limes and kumquats and mandarin oranges and things. And I believe that a lot of the plants that are being sold in the local nurseries for interior citrus growth are grafted onto a different root system. I believe that that is probably absolutely correct. And they do stay fairly small. The root system, though, keeping that root system happy really is the most important thing when you're talking about growing any kind of containerized plants, but especially a plant that's going to be flowering and producing fruit. So you know, I've talked to you several times, and I know that you really care about this and you're really trying, but I'm almost wondering if you're loving your plants too much.
Yeah, you know, Limey does not like a ton of water, for example. Yeah, I water every
My Bear's Lime, I have in an unglazed clay pot, and it's a 14-inch clay pot filled with just a standard potting mix. You know, it's a soilless potting mix that you can buy at any garden center, a nice, clean, soilless potting mix, and just a really standard thing. I incorporated some slow-release fertilizer in that potting mix, so you can buy various kinds of slow-release potting fertilizers to mix in. And then about once a month, I do fertilize those plants with a... I don't use the fish emulsion because I have a dog that would just go nuts if I did that. So I just use a regular inorganic kind of fertilizer mix that contains a lot of extra. It's like more of a complete fertilizer. It has magnesium in it and calcium and iron and all of those things. Citrus do have kind of a high fertility need, and so you do need to pick that fertilizer carefully to make sure that it's a good one. But once you choose a fertilizer, you need to follow the label instructions, because you truly can kill a plant by loving it too much and giving it too much water, too much fertilizer, too much nitrogen, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, choose a fertilizer that's designed for flowering plants. That's really the best one to do, and try to get one that's... complete.
And go with I really like the Bear's Lime. I mean, there are other ones.
I like the Bear's Lime. And the Eureka and the Meyer's Lemon are good.
I'm going to go with a Eureka Lemon. I've got to try that.
Yeah. It's a bigger plant, though. Meyer's Lemons and those little kumquats and those things tend to stay a little bit smaller. And the Bear's Lime, of course, is a much smaller plant. But yeah. My Eureka Lemons, I prune them annually because otherwise they would hit the ceiling. I keep them at about 5 feet tall, okay. But one of them has exceeded that right now, so I'm looking at it very critically. In my head, I'm looking at it critically right this minute, thinking, I need to cut that thing back.
And Limey's about half the size of that.
Right, and my lime is also smaller than that. It's only about 2 feet tall.
Yeah.
But it branches out. It's more horizontal growing.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. There we go, Norman. Thanks.
Good luck. You know, I'm going to say don't give up, but maybe cut back on the love. I don't usually say that, but cut back on the love.
Thanks, Norman. Yeah. Janelle and Hilbert, thank you for calling. Hi.
I am having issues getting peppers growing in my garden.
Oh. Are they not producing, or are they just not leafing out and growing nicely?
The plants look beautiful.
Oh, good.
And I do see the blossoms. But if I get peppers, they're very small.
Oh, interesting.
If I get them.
Huh. When do you plant?
I always wait until after Mother's Day.
Okay.
Yeah. And
okay.
I typically plant my peppers
early.
And tomatoes at the same time.
Okay. So there are a lot of things that can happen. Where do you live?
In Hilbert.
I don't have any clue where that is.
the northeast side of Lake Winnebago.
Oh, okay. So it's a different zone than what I'm growing in, but... You might be planting a little bit early. What I would recommend for this year are several things. First of all, invest in a soil thermometer.
Okay.
So they're very inexpensive. You can buy them online for like $3. You can probably find them. If they don't have them in your garden center, it's one of those things that I always say, tell them to buy them, because every gardener should have a soil thermometer. Peppers, tomatoes, eggplant are so sensitive to cold soil. And if you're planting them in May and your soil is still around that 50-degree mark, they might be getting some chilling damage, which could have very long-term effects. So there are a couple of things you can do. You can buy pepper plants early and put them in pots and keep the soil nice and warm, bring them in inside. You know, you can try to warm up your soil outdoors by putting down a layer of plastic and monitoring the soil temperature really carefully to make sure that it's really absorbing the heat from the sun and getting warm. Raised beds, containers typically have warmer soil than in-ground beds. so they warm up a little bit sooner. But I would be very careful about that soil temperature. The second thing that I would recommend is to look at least three different cultivars of peppers to try.
Yeah.
And make sure that it's not a cultivar problem. Look for some of the peppers that say that they will produce in 50 to 60 days as opposed to 70 or 80. Look, and you know, when you start looking in these seed catalogs and online, they're just amazing numbers in all different types and shapes and colors of peppers to choose from. But look specifically for the ones that are short season peppers.
Okay.
And you'll have better luck with that. The other thing is the fertility of your soil. If you're getting really nice lush green growth, it could be that you have way too much nitrogen in your soil. And so you might want to look at incorporating only compost and not putting any fertilizer, any additional fertilizer in, and see if that helps with the fertility.
You know, here in Madison, I don't even put peppers in until
I don't plant mine until the end of May. I don't plant mine until the end of May, the first week of June. Even down in Racine, and you know, our teaching garden is right on the lake, but we typically don't put the peppers in until Memorial Day
weekend. Because if you get a cold snap,
yeah. But you know, it's funny. You know, they can tolerate a little bit of cold, and you can cover them. You know, if there's like a little light late frost or something. But the soil temperature can really inhibit growth and development. If you put those warm season plants out in cold soil and they get cold roots, you can have chilling damage that has very long-lasting effects.
I had four or five different pepper plants in my straw bale garden.
How'd they do?
Oh, great.
Yeah, so some of my peppers did well in the straw bales and some of them didn't. And I planted this year in my raised beds in the straw bales, and then I have a community garden plot up in kind of like the northwest Milwaukee area. I planted, I think I had 12 different types of peppers.
Wow.
All different colors.
Yeah,
Hot ones, but mostly different types of sweet ones because I've been playing around with like those little baby bells and yum-yum peppers, trying to get those little snacking peppers.
Yep.
But they didn't produce for me as well as some of the standards like Red Mercury or even the California bell peppers.
I didn't try the small one.
But the purple ones produced really well, too.
Yeah, really.
And they did really well in those straw bales, the purple pepper.
I had some really hot ones. Oh, my goodness me. They were...
Yeah.
You couldn't... I mean, you would like... a little speck from pepper.
Right now, I'm the only one in my family who can eat the hot peppers, so I took all of my jalapenos and pickled them, and I was the only one who could eat them. But I just finished that up last weekend, actually. All of my hot peppers are now gone. So good luck with the peppers, and keep trying, but, you know, it's one of those... everybody's soil is a little bit different. Everybody's environment is a little bit different. And you keep trying different cultivars. Sometimes it's a cultivar thing.
Yeah. Cheryl and Owen, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. My question is about my apple orchard. I'm starting to have some problems. Last year, one of my favorite apple trees, Moon Glow, died. And I had been treating it for a couple years for fire blight.
Oh, that's a hard one, yeah.
And I spray dormant oil in the spring as well as Bordeaux mix, and it totally died this last summer.
I'm sorry.
And in late fall, or it might have been middle fall, we've had a long fall this year.
Right.
But I noticed that some of my trees, the tips of their leaves were starting to look like they might be succumbing to fire blight. And I'm not sure what else to do.
Right.
Also, there's on a couple of my trees, there are some splits that I don't think are due to the winter freeze in thaw, the impact of the sun. And they're starting to ooze a goo. So
that's not good.
No.
And I've got 16 trees, and I, you know, even losing one is bad. And I have one more question. I have six Honeycrisp apples, and this summer I lived directly in central Wisconsin. There was a particularly stormy storm, and the wind blew over two of my Honeycrisp, and they were probably about 7 years old. And I'm just wondering if you know if Honeycrisp have a root system that may not be as sturdy as it should be?
Well, they're grafted, so yeah. I'm not sure which root system you would have on those. You'd have to go back and look at whatever paperwork you got when you bought those trees to see what kind of root system they have. There are some dwarf and semi-dwarf, and there's some like super dwarf root systems that are really not very big. We have some apple trees in the teaching garden that have such tiny little root systems that they have to stay staked all the time or they would just fall over completely. You have a lot of things going on and probably more than we can really address in the radio show, but I would suggest that you go to learningstore.uwex.edu to the UW Extension Publications website and look at those apple publications. There are some instructions on how to deal with fire blight. Fire blight is a bacterial disease, so a lot of the things that you're talking about using don't really help for fire blight. Fire blight is primarily pruned out. But if you're not cleaning your pruning tools correctly, you could be spreading it to tree from tree to tree. And so pruning is the primary way that fire blight is controlled. But if you get those bacterial organisms on your pruning tools or on your gloves or on your hands or whatever, you know, every time you go to another tree, you could be spreading that disease yourself. The one with the cracking and oozing, that's going to be one of those lovely fungal cankers. And you could get it diagnosed by sending some samples in to the disease diagnostic clinic here at UW-Madison. But it doesn't really matter. You're going to have to take those trees out because there's no cure for that at all.
There is no cure. And you want to get rid of it.
Really do. But I think it's important if you're going to grow fruit trees and apple trees, and it's great that you're doing it, but they do require a lot of care. So it's good that you are looking for some additional information. And I would highly recommend the Growing Apples in Wisconsin and the other publications concerning apple diseases and apple training apple trees that are available on the Learning Store.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much for calling. And Jana in London, we'll go to you. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Since you're on the subject of citrus trees, I've been listening to that for years and been meaning to call in. I have a 15-year-old grapefruit tree that currently is gorgeous. I almost lost it to mites a couple of times, but the seed came from a half a grapefruit that I was eating. And
you're not getting any grapefruit.
No, it's a nice shiny leaf.
No, it's a beautiful tree, but you probably will not ever get any fruit on it.
And is this, and why again?
Well, because the seed are, you know, that's a result of sexual propagation, and you've got different genetics in that seed that are in the main plant. And most of the citrus that we grow are grown from grafted vegetative propagation.
Yeah, and so, and if you keep it for how it looks.
Right.
It's pretty, maybe. And if not, we can buy grapefruit trees.
Yeah, you can buy some dwarf grapefruit trees that will produce
that
flowers
will,
and fruit inside.
And frankly, if you've got really good, healthy tree, you probably have a very good environment and you're doing a good job.
Now, if you lived in Florida and that tree was outside, eventually it would produce flowers and fruit, but it won't in Wisconsin. So so it looks like Bev is on line one.
Yeah. And we're going to go to Bev Baker, who's up. Family living educator and department.
She's head. My boss today. She's my boss.
Yeah, she's head of UW Extension in Racine County. Bev, are you there?
I am. Thanks for inviting me on.
Well, I really wanted to have you come on today and talk a little about Patty on this her last day with UW Extension. What are some of the best things about working with Patty? I've got my own ideas.
Well, I took a poll this morning at our office from Patty's colleagues, and we all agreed the top one was, she's fun. She's just a blast to be around. And they described it as, you know, all of a sudden they'll hear this explosion of humor and laughter down the hallway and know, oh, Patty's here today.
Yes.
And then she just has this way of finding the best in everyone and, and makes our team a fun time. The second one that, again, everyone said was on their list as well was her knowledge. And you all the listeners have experienced this along with Larry, is she can translate some pretty complex science into real understandable terms, and you make sense and you know what to do with that information. So just an incredible base of knowledge that she's brought to us. And then the third one is her passion to share that knowledge and to help communities and volunteers and people achieve the goals that they're wanting to achieve.
And she has she's quite a little legacy, hasn't she?
She does, and we just celebrated her career on Wednesday night, and so there were three themes that came out. And again, this, you know, so there's Patty, but Patty has this whole group of people around her, whether it's a Master Gardener volunteer team or community partners, so it's Patty and her people.
I love my people.
People. The first one was community gardens. And, you know, Patty was in my office after the first garden had some issues, and that's a whole other show. And she said, we're not doing community gardens anymore. I'm done with it. And then a few months later, she goes, okay, well, we're going to have two new community gardens. Like this phoenix happened. And so they do amazing things to grow produce, to provide that place where people can learn about gardening in urban areas in Racine. Out of that came the People and Plants People Plus Plants publication. And Dan Tavelkowski, who's just an amazing community partner at the Racine County Food Bank, said they're actually going to name the teaching pavilion after Patty in her honor. So that's pretty cool. So her name will live on there. The second one came out of a county board budget hearing where we were there, obviously, Master Gardeners were there for a different reason, but they heard about parents that had adult children with disabilities and the need for programs and resources, and Master Gardener said, let's do something about this, and Merrill, who's worked with so closely with Patty over the last decade, and talked Patty into it as well. And so Patty's done helped create this GreenWorks program that focuses on therapeutic horticulture. And most recently, they're working at the Wisconsin Veterans Home. And you know, she uses horticulture in a way that engages people who oftentimes won't engage in other ways, but this is just has a certain kind of magic that she's brought to it. So I would say GreenWorks and therapeutic horticulture. And then the third one is the amazing team of Master Gardener volunteers that she's worked with over the years. And, you know, she really has instilled that fun, that knowledge, and that passion in them.
Well, and the fourth is all she's done with us here at Wisconsin Public Radio. It's been wonderful having Patty with us. And you may have get a little feedback on that as well, Bev, from time to time.
Yes. In a good way, of course.
Well,
I've been rendered speechless and am on the brink of tears again, but
well, you know, I was going to try to come into Madison. I thought, no, it's probably better to have us see each other. Otherwise, we both would be in.
We'll both be crying again. So it's, you know, it's been
and
a
me
great
too.
Run. Yeah. I do love what I do, and I love helping people and answering their questions, and it's been a constant learning process for me as well. Larry and I were talking about this earlier. I learn from everybody that I have the pleasure of working with, you know, with respect to these different gardening programs, and so it's a beautiful thing.
Bev, thank you very, very much for calling in. I really appreciate it. And, of course, Patty. What can I say? Thank you. Okay. You're always welcome.
Thank you. And I, you know, I've got more free time now, Larry. So,
yeah, write that book and then come back and we'll.
Right. I have been. It's just been a real pleasure working with UW Extension and working with WPR over the years. I have met so many amazing people and have had the pleasure to work with so many wonderful people in this state, and it has just been amazing. Thank you.
Patty Nagai. She'll be back. We're going to have her back on the show. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening. And gosh, please stay with us. There's lots more good things in store for us here on the Ideas Network. of Wisconsin Public Radio.